Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. This is our credit focus series. We've done roughly 20 of these thus far. And this one, though, we think is going to get the most hype. And our very first podcast was YA Global. And now our 21st one, or right around 21st, is going to be what happened with this new court case here with the YA Global. So this is Pat Brooks, and with me is Sam Riesenberg. You all probably have heard Sam many a times. He is part of our Washington National Tax International practice, and he focuses a great deal on credit funds and credit issues. So, Sam, let's get right into this thing.
Great.
Maybe it's good just to talk about what we talked about a year ago, 2 years ago, that first podcast, YA Global. What was going on with this?
Sure. So you need to set the stage a little bit with YA Global. You have to remember this is an area where we have a dearth of case law or guidance, and that's specifically in when do foreigners get taxed in the U.S. on their loan origination activities performed by agents in the U.S. And even that concept of agency, when is a fund manager your agent, was at issue in this case. So this is a case that a lot of people will tell you is very narrow and specific to its facts, and maybe that's so. But this is also a case that has the potential for broader implications simply because there's just nothing else out there to grab onto to say, well, what is the law in this area that's developing very quickly commercially, but rather slowly in terms of tax legislation guidance that we can find. So the YA Global facts themselves are in the mid-2000s going into the tax years at issue. YA Global was doing these standby equity distribution agreements. And these are effectively equity-linked credit-type opportunities that were being offered to portfolio companies. And what they would do is they'd offer these opportunities for liquidity, essentially, to portfolio companies that did not have the ability to necessarily go out to the market to raise the capital as efficiently. It was quite lucrative. They made a fair amount of money on it, but they were claiming from a tax perspective that they were not in a trader business. And the IRS challenged that. And now we know, as the YA Global decision came out a couple of days ago, that the IRS won and was able to successfully challenge them at tax court that they were deemed to be engaged in a trader business, the result being taxation and full taxation in the hands of the non-U.S. investors on their profits associated with the business.
We're going to get back to the full taxation piece of this and all that stuff. But if you sort of just take a step back and say, okay, that's great, that's a little history. What's sort of the general overview of this case? I mean, there's many different prongs they went into to really hammer the taxpayer, I think. So maybe just give an overview and then we could just sort of parcel it out a little bit.
Yeah, so the first part of the case really goes deeply into what is an agent, because one of the things that the taxpayer was trying to argue was, I don't have any trader business, right, a taxable branch in the U.S., because I don't have an agent that I'm acting through in the U.S. I only have a service provider. And so the court deals with this issue at length and says, this really was an agency relationship. In fact, they went into a lot of detail on that, from my perspective, surprisingly so, and really kind of went, you know, point by point and disputed that out in about 15 pages. So that's quite a large portion of the case, just to then get to the trader business issue. The court set up the trader business issue as, well, was it regular and continuous? That's an issue we spent a lot of time on. Unfortunately, the court didn't spend a lot of time on there, basically saying, well, we can all see this is regular and continuous to some degree. There's a bit more than that. But really focusing in then on the earning of fees. And they said, look, the manager is receiving fees for setting up these standby agreements. Those fees are for the performance of services within the U.S. So that is per se effectively connected income. And therefore, those fees being passed on net of expenses to the fund was earning ECI, which effectively connected income with the United States branch. And therefore, we have a U.S. trader business. And the court doesn't say exactly what that U.S. trader business is. They talk about a lot of different things that could be the U.S. trader business, but they say there is a U.S. trader business and that the fees are associated with it. And then the court goes on to say, okay, well, how much of the fund's income is connected with that trader business? And they say, well, the fund is entering into these agreements. They're effectively loans. These loans are being held as effectively as dealer property by a dealer. And under Section 475, which deals with dealers and their inventory treatment, these are all inventory of a dealer. And therefore, bring that back to the international provisions, all part of basically your U.S. taxable branch. And so the court concludes that all of the income is subject to U.S. tax that was earned by the fund because it's all connected with U.S. branch as part of being part of the dealer book. The court says you could have made an election to get out of it, but you didn't make the election under the 475 rules. And then the court goes on and says, okay, well, you should have withheld, right? Because withholding is a required component of when you have a partnership engaged in a U.S. trader business. The proceeds need to be withheld to foreign partners so that the IRS, the U.S. FISC, can collect the tax on a withholding basis and this doesn't get paid out gross under Section 1446. The court goes on to conclude that because they didn't do their 1446 withholding, and furthermore, they did not file the required statements to do the withholding on a net basis, the court then went on and said, well, you therefore are liable for the gross amount of tax, essentially tax on the entire amount without deductions, which is quite a harsh result for the taxpayer.
Yeah, that one is something that we all try to protect our clients from, that, okay, if you get a hit with tax, okay, let's just make sure it's net of tax if you can. In this case, I mean, they're getting walloped. They're getting hit with the full caboodle. I'm sorry for my old phrases here, by the way, with wallop and caboodle.
No problem. Yeah. It's certainly, if you don't have any other takeaway from this case, that there's two requirements that you should do if you think that there's any risk whatsoever of U.S. taxation, branch taxation, a U.S. trader business technically, then, but you're going to file as if you don't have it because you think maybe that's the better argument. You first file protective returns. Right? Have an entity that's sitting there because that's the swallows holding issue. That's right. You can still deny net deductions if you don't file a tax return. That wasn't necessarily the issue here. The issue with the second one is if you don't file the forms 8804 associated with the withholding tax for effectively connected income with the U.S. branch, then you could also get hit with a gross basis tax. And so they definitely fell into that second trap. And that's a, you know, something that I think everyone's going to be looking at very closely going forward.
So we hear all this and our clients are saying, okay, this is good. But clients are sort of, these facts are a little bit narrow in some cases here.
That's right.
So which clients or what type of clients you think may be most affected, and maybe other clients that probably don't have these specific facts, but still should have concern. But if you sort of bifurcate the two, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that anyone that has fee offsets or different types of certainly unusual fee arrangements going through their structure should have those reviewed very, very quickly. It was something that the court in this instance was able to grab onto and kind of use as a basis for attaching taxation to the rest of the fund. Whether that's the right way to look at it or not more generally, and whether it affects a broader range or subset of funds, I think that it's very, very important to review any kind of fee offset, particularly ECI fee offset and fee waivers, I think is going to be very, very important. I'm not certainly coming out on this podcast and saying there's something wrong with those and that this court holds that doesn't work anymore, but I think that there certainly gives you pause and cause for concern that you need to look at those different arrangements. The other piece that I think was interesting with this case is the, as we just discussed, the forms 8804. I think a lot of people weren't filing those that probably should have. And they said, hey, I'm protected from gross basis taxation by just filing my tax return. And I think the judge here felt that wasn't the case and said that I can still get to gross basis and not give you your deductions by just saying you didn't file your 8804s when you should have. I think that that's going to be a very, very important part of this case as well. And finally, I think that for a certain subset of the market, there's maybe not as much attention paid to the risk of a U.S. trader business more generally. And I think that this case will serve as a timely reminder to many funds that maybe don't even have a tax person in-house that are saying, okay, well, I don't need to worry about that. I'm with the market. It's no big deal. We're seeing a lot more partnership audits. We're seeing the loan origination audit campaign. We're going to see more rather than less activity in this area as the IRS gets up to speed on this. And so I think this is going to be, you know, something that you're going to need to watch out for more generally, even if you feel that the facts here are very, very narrow.
Yeah, that one is really interesting. As we didn't really have any cases or anything directly on point, people get a little more confident. And with that confidence, they might take a few more shortcuts. And as a result, they're like, yeah, well, look, there's been nothing out here for 30 years. And so why should they do anything? And people get a little more risk, get a little riskier. So I think that's a really good point too, Sam, is that just we just need to, all clients need to just go back, look at all their facts, look at all their support, and just make sure it's all in line with what they were trying to do and they weren't maybe taking on some additional risks, and assess it against the facts of this case. That's what I would think.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's always good to think about the worst case scenarios. The kind of mantra of it only rains when I go outside without my umbrella kind of concept, right? You know, you just need to be thinking about the concepts that how could they apply to you? What's the widest possible piece? Because the entire industry is now going without cases really in this area for a long time. We have a case that's in this area. Now we need to think about what it might mean. And the question is, are we going to see more cases? I think the answer has to be yes.
I've heard that phrase before. I just, that analogy, I haven't heard it, though, in this case, but I think it's fantastic. So Sam, thank you so much for your time. That this was great. And everyone who's listening, we do appreciate you listening. We hope that you're getting out of this what you need to really focus on those areas and those issues that we feel are important. So this is the end of this podcast, Talking Asset Management with KPMG and the Credit Fund Series. And everyone, just take care. Have a great day. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. Take care.